Welcome back to the program. I've often quoted the former head of Sun Microsystems, Scott McNeely, who said over a decade ago, "There is no privacy, get over it." That was even before Facebook and Foursquare and location-based retail. To a large extent, it raises the question as to whether or not there is a generational divide regarding our attitudes about privacy. But what we don't often think about is that the divide is not only generational, but it goes to our attitudes about culture, economics, and class. We're going to talk about privacy in the context of these issues today with my guest, Garrett Kaiser. He's a contributing editor at Harper's, and he's the author of a new book entitled Privacy. Garrett Kaiser, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
One of the things that you contend in privacy is that this is an issue not just about generations and about technology, but there are more fundamental issues at play with respect to the discussion of privacy.
Yes, and one of them you mentioned in your introduction, which is the issue of class and the distribution of resources.
How does that impact privacy and vice versa?
Well, it impacts privacy in a couple of ways. Most obviously, it impacts privacy in terms of how much real privacy you actually enjoy and how much private life you enjoy. If you feel in your life that you would like more privacy, as the fellow who said get over it undoubtedly has a great deal of it, I'm sure, in his own life, if you wish to aspire to that level of privacy, what sorts of things would you do? You would probably go to a realtor. You might go to a lawyer. You might go to someone who sells certain kinds of security systems. In short, you would check certain items off a list that's unavailable to people of lesser income, as is just the privilege of enjoying private life itself. We have Fourth Amendment protections in this country against warrantless searches of our house, but that right becomes somewhat abstract if you don't have a house, if your house has just gone up on a foreclosure sale, or if you're sleeping under a bridge abutment. We talk a lot about, the protection of our Social Security numbers, even as some people are going to be languishing without Social Security. On a more deeper level, however, privacy as a right, and this is true of all rights, depends upon a social contract. And that's especially interesting and even ironic in the case of privacy, because most of us, I think, when we hear the word privacy, we think of ourselves alone, apart from others. I'm going into this room and I wish to be private. These are my papers and I wish them to be private. But it's only our togetherness that really allows us to be apart. Otherwise, there's no real right to privacy. It's just the privilege of privacy. And it's as good as the might or the money that you can muster to protect privacy. But privacy depends on a social contract. And I believe that the vast discrepancies that we see now between those who have and those who have not represents a kind of breakdown of the social contract, that they're as much social warning signs as disappearing ice caps are scientific warning signs. And if the social contract disappears, if the term fellow Americans becomes increasingly abstract, if we begin to look at our national brothers and sisters almost as if we belong to different species, then the right to privacy and other rights too begin to lose their moorings and the foundations underneath them begin to tremble. And I think we're seeing that now.
I want to talk about the ways in which we're seeing that, because whether or not there's a direct cause and effect relationship, or it is merely the unintended consequences of the way technology and information travels today, seems to be a question in all this. The degree to which you can use resources in order to create more privacy, in order to deal with the technological spread of information, seems to be what's at play here, more a result of economic resources as opposed to an impact of having more or less economic resources.
Well, when we use a word like technology, I think that we need to be clear about what we mean, because increasingly, at least as I parse it, that word has two meanings. One, the meaning that ostensibly is the only one, is a body of sophisticated electronic devices that have been used both to protect privacy and to undermine privacy. One of the ironies I point to in my book is that many of the digital devices that have enabled us to be scrutinized and followed and monitored were first marketed to us as with the promise that we would have more privacy. You know, you have a personal computer, you don't have to go to the library. You have a GPS, you don't have to roll down your windows and ask directions. You even have a VCR, you don't have to go to the movies. And yet, all of these devices, in fact, open windows so that our digital caves of seclusion turn out to be glass houses. The devices are one meaning of technology, but there's another meaning, and that is a kind of ideology with silicon. It's technology, in some senses, is almost a kind of fundamentalist religion that sees the only way to salvation to be through the use of certain devices, and who sees technology as this kind of force, this implacable force like fate.
But in many ways, sorry to interrupt you for a second, in many ways it is. In many ways it represents science and progress, both of which are immutable forces.
Well, they are immutable forces to some degree, but they are still forces that are mustered by human beings and that are managed by those who own the means of production and who direct those forces for their own uses. So to speak of technology, and of course it's very convenient to speak of it that way, in that kind of fatalistic sense of a blind force that can't be resisted, because then the citizen says, well, it's just little old me, and there's the forward march of progress,
but
and
what
there's
about,
nothing we can do about it. There is.
But what about the creative destruction that's inherent in that, where when you talk about the means of production, one of the things the technology has done to a large extent is level the playing field. It has lowered the barriers to entry in so many different areas.
Well, it has in so many different areas, but perhaps not in as many areas as we would like to think. Just look at some of the demographic information about who has access to the technology, who has a personal computer, who lives in an area where broadband internet is available, and you'll find that those figures are all skewed according to age, according to rural life, and that minorities tend to have disproportionately less of technology, and that's not the fault of technology. They have disproportionately less of a lot of other things. But I would suggest that that so-called creative destruction, which Schumpeter talked about being a part of capitalism and is part of the forward march of technology, is not a given of the technology. Vaclav Havel, after, you know, participating in the overthrow of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia and then becoming president of Czechoslovakia, talks in one of his interviews about, you know, the clunky state apparatus that controlled industry in Czechoslovakia. But then he contrasts that with a corporation like IBM in America, and he even says in some ways IBM is worse, and the reason he said it was worse is because those who develop these tools have no say in how they're used, and their uses are considered irrespective of the human value and the social value of the devices, but are only promoted in terms of, you know, more is better, and especially if more translates as more money for few people.
But those are decisions made by individuals. The technology itself, the device, is morally neutral.
The technology itself is morally neutral, I would agree.
So that when we look at technology, for example, let's take the developing world in so many parts of Africa today, where everybody has cell phones all of a sudden, and suddenly that technology is helping lift people out of poverty and out of terrible conditions.
Well, again, my argument is not with technology, but with our ideological constructions around technology and with the economic assumptions with which we distribute technology. As far as whether everyone having a cell phone in Africa is lifting the standard of living, I must be behind the times on the news, because it's, you know, I see a lot of hungry people, and I see a lot of people. I don't even need to go to Africa to see people with cell phones, but without other necessities of life. I remember having a discussion with a school librarian not long ago who wished to enlist my services in a campaign that she wanted to launch that would provide a laptop for every student in a rural community. And I said, that sounds like a great idea, but might we consider starting with seeing that every kid in this community has a breakfast, that every kid in this community has a safe home to go to return to, that every kid in this community can educate himself or herself with the promise of some kind of meaningful work, which can be facilitated by technology, but it's not always facilitated by technology. There are a lot of people right now who cannot have a private life because it is a requirement of their jobs that they have their cell phones on at all hours, that they have, that they be plugged into the internet at all hours. And that, again, to return to your very good point, is not a fault of technology, but it's certainly a way that technology is being used to erode private life. The other day, I had a man ask me a question. He said, what do you think of these employers who, as a condition, a precondition of employment, want prospective job applicants to reveal their Facebook passwords? And I said, well, that's a very good question. Why don't we take one step back from that, and why don't you ask me the even better question of what I think about employers who assume that having a Facebook page is a prerequisite to being an employable human being.
Is it, though, a zero-sum game? In other words, we can look at all of these things and see the degree to which they are misused in some cases, and the degree to which privacy is taken advantage of in some situations by employers, as you talk about. That doesn't make the technology or the opportunity to have access to these things for the individual doesn't necessarily make it inherently bad or a problem.
Of course not. And I've not said that and never would.
Mm-hmm.
As far as whether it's a zero-sum game, I guess that depends on whether we still retain the idea that we have some ability to do the accounting, that we have some ability to balance the books. If the numbers are just being computed on this kind of, you know, fatalistic loom of cause and effect, and human society and human production are not in the hands of human beings, then I suppose there's not much we can say about it. And I suppose that I'm a fool for writing a book, because why would we want to read about these ideas, or why would you and I want to discuss them if we are powerless to do anything to change the dynamics of the way they work? All we're doing is mumbling to one another as we slip off to sleep. I happen to believe that we can do better.
Does it seem that we're in a balancing act in some respects between privacy on the one hand and transparency on the other?
We are, and we always have been. And privacy, although I've written a book about privacy, and I'm obviously advocating for its importance, and obviously resist the idea of it being a luxury, so-called, that we can do without, as promoted by people who have that luxury and every other, I would not make privacy an absolute. It is always in tension with other values. It's in tension with the value of freedom of the press, which is necessary to a free and self-governing society. It's in tension with issues of the safety of individuals. One person can claim that what goes on in his house is his right to privacy, even as he's smacking around his own kids. So privacy will always exist in tension with other values. Where we begin to lose our focus and our grip is when we start resolving those tensions in simplistic ways. So we say, well, openness and transparency are always good, and nobody with nothing to hide has anything to fear from showing everything about their lives. And now we've settled all that, and we can just go back and find a nice place to eat lunch. That's when I think we start getting into trouble. And of course, those kinds of simplistic resolutions of the tension serve the aims of certain forces in society that sometimes would like us to give up our rights, or to give up the struggle that's necessary to be a free people. And that includes not only the struggle with the powers that be, with which on which this country was founded, but also it includes the struggle between competing values, which every person in their own life, in their family life, you know, you got a kid and there's the value that he needs to do his homework, and there's also the value that if he does homework and nothing else, he's going to become a very sad and sick little human being. So mom and dad have to say, well, we can't throw the books out, but we're not going to throw your baseball glove out either. But where do we find, as you say, the balance between those things?
On that same note, in many ways, as we look at the way technology has created so little privacy in so many respects today, the fact that technology on every level, whether it's government or whether it's young people using Facebook, the technology in many ways has created this permeable membrane through which information passes. Arguably, we're going to have to look to technology to create greater privacy. Once again, the pendulum is going to have to swing technologically in the other direction.
Well, I think that the pendulum may swing in the other direction, but I would just, with respect, express two reservations to what you have just said. I don't think I want to say that technology has created these membranes, because that again starts to treat technology as a force unto itself. When people are gathering my information and using that for smart marketing, that's not technology that's doing that. That's people using technology to do that, and that's a difference. That's something different. I agree that technology can be used to enhance privacy, but if we see the problem as purely technological and the solution as purely technological, then we play into that current mythology, and I think it really is a mythology, an ideology, just about a fundamentalist religion, that everything worthwhile is going to happen on the screen. And I think many of the things that are worthwhile, including the protection of privacy, including the better uses of technology, are not going to happen on the screen. They're going to happen where they've always happened, which is on the streets.
But, of course, the way in which, whether it's governments doing good or ill, or corporations and marketers doing good or ill, that their ability to do that, their ability to have so much information, to aggregate the information, to be able to do things with it, not always things that we want, that is as a direct result of technological innovation.
Well, yes, and of every other innovation, I mean, from the first discovery of fire to how to tame horses. Suddenly these marauders appear in the village and they're on horses and you've never even seen horses, or they have cannon and you've never even seen cannon. So all of these tools give an advantage, and whoever owns the tools has the advantage. And the question for me is, are we at a point in civilization where we can direct the distribution of those tools in such a way? And perhaps this goes contrary to our human nature. Perhaps the tragic conditions of humanity prevent this. But again, if I give into that, then why bother writing books? Are we at a point where we can have those means at our disposal, at our shared disposal, in such a way that they're not working to give one group of people an uncontested advantage over another group of people, but where they are giving all of us as people a better edge in dealing with the tragic conditions of our existence, disease, death, loneliness, deformity, all of those things, and our shared ownership of those means, and a kind of shared agenda as to how those means are best employed, will give us not a perfect society. I'm not a utopian, but a society where, as Peter Moran said, where it is easier for people to be good.
In many ways, that goes counter, arguably, to some notions of privacy. I know you talk early on in the book about the difference between let me alone and leave me alone, but the degree to which we all move towards our own personal private bubble takes us further and further out of that public commons.
Well, I think you're raising a very important point, and one that goes right to the core of my reasons for writing the book, which not only have to do with the philosophical poles that you're talking about, but with certain contrary poles in my own personality. I am a private person, a person who values his privacy and who values solitude. I mean, it's almost a joke among my friends about, you know, which social invitations I'm going to accept, and probably as few as possible, even while I maintain this strong ideological belief in a more social democracy and in a society where everybody has what they need. So there, again, as we were talking about before, there is a tension. But I wrote the book to explore whether that's an irresolvable tension, whether or not we can find perhaps even a more authentic and a deeper privacy in a society where everyone's needs are met. You know, the impulse to snoop is often based on a kind of inequality. I want to look at what you got to see if it's more than what I've got, or to see if I can get more of what you've got. What's on your plate? But if we all have a decent piece of the pie, I guess I'm more concerned with eating my pie than with snooping at what you have. I'm not suggesting that the tension you're talking about between retreat into our own bubbles and the building of a better public square or a better society, that tension doesn't exist. It does. It exists in me, and it exists in my society. But I think that some creative things could come out of that tension if it's recognized and if it's grappled with intelligence and with a combination of public engagement and private reflection. Privacy and public institutions are not opposites. They are complements. They're sides of the same coin. And the proof of that is when one is degraded, the other is almost always degraded. If you degrade public life, if democracy becomes flaccid, if people's commitment to the welfare of their neighbors begins to grow weak, you find privacy eroding. And if privacy is strengthened, think of the people you know that you would say, wow, these people know how to live a private life. If your circle's like my circle, most of those same people who enjoy their privacy and who enjoy their private lives gloriously and sensuously are engaged publicly. They're engaged civically. They're engaged with their neighbors. The one supports and nourishes the other.
And yet, if you look at young people today, you come away with a slightly different picture of all that. You see a generation that in many ways seems to eschew a certain amount of privacy. They certainly are much more transparent in terms of their private lives and what they're willing to have out there in the public. They have very little faith in those public institutions, and yet they are, a large percentage of them are committed to doing good and do believe in a broader social contract, but not through the traditional public institutions.
Well, I've looked at young people too. In fact, I have now at this point in my life a number of friends who are younger than I am, and I also taught school for a number of years. So I don't want to, you know, take my experience of young people and say it trumps what you see or what other people see. I would just question the idea without totally refuting it, because it may be true, that young people as a group are less concerned with privacy than their elders were. That is the received narrative, no doubt. Young people today don't care about privacy. They're showing it all on Facebook and MySpace. But what I would like to know are a couple of things. First of all, is that good social analysis, or is that just smart marketing? To what extent is that the line that's being fed to young people by people who have, you know, very vested economic interests in having young people believe that? You're the generation who doesn't care about privacy. You're the guys who just like to let it all hang out. And, of course, we're the guys who like to watch it hang out and then make money off that. And that's who you are as a generation. And so I think in some ways it's a bill of goods that's been sold to young people, and I have a feeling that many young people are going to critique it. I'm also old enough to remember a generation where privacy was coming apart quite easily without any help from Facebook or MySpace. I grew up in the age of Candid Camera. I grew up in the age of An American Family on PBS. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the age of counterculture communes with everybody sitting on this a toilet in a one big room looking at each other. So, you know, to lay this in the hands of the young is a problem. But just for the sake of argument, let's say that everything is true about the hypothesis that young people don't care about their privacy. I guess what I would say to that is, well, where did they get that from? You know, young people learn and absorb the values of their culture.
Or rebel against them.
People love to say young people can't learn. No, it's adults can't keep good track of what they teach. And what we've taught young people, and we teach it by the pay scale of the society, is that there is almost nothing higher to which a human being can aspire than celebrity. And then along come these social networking sites that give you the illusion, that allow you. It's like, you know, when I was growing up and had all the westerns on TV, you could go to little amusement parks and pretend you were a cowboy and strap on a six shooter and shoot the bank robber and the bell rang. Now you can become Lindsay Lohan on your Facebook page. But who provided young people? I find it's not that I devalue young people. I found many young people very smart and very challenging and all of that stuff. But where do we get this notion that, you know, culture is the product of 14-year-olds? We've given them that culture, and they've taken to it no less than an Iroquois young man picked up a bow and arrow. They're picking up their cell phones. But that Iroquois young man didn't invent the bow and arrow. He did not come up with the idea that he should go out looking for scalps. That was given to him. That was passed to him at the village fire. And what we see among young people is something, and there's one other thing, too, that I think that's often cleverly used as a way to avoid looking at the breaches of privacy that are being visited on us by government and big business. So what we say is, oh, man, look at the things these crazy kids are doing on Facebook and MySpace. Man, they don't have any concern for privacy. And meanwhile, we're being spied on all over the place. But we're turning this into a story about kooky kids who don't care about privacy, when it's more accurately rendered perhaps as sheepish citizens who are all too willing to relinquish their privacy.
And one wonders the degree to which that relinquishing of privacy has a kind of countercultural aspect to it. I mean, you were talking about counterculture in the 60s, although this seems very tame in some respects by comparison. There is an element of counterculturalism to the lack of privacy and to the desire for celebrity. And as these young people get older, all these college students that share everything on Facebook, they may change their attitudes about this, whether or not they'll be able to erase the bits and bytes that created that is an open question. But arguably, their attitudes, as they become co-opted by the culture, their attitudes may change.
Their attitudes may indeed change, and they probably will change, because it's human for that to happen, and history indicates that it will happen. In regard to counterculturalism, I guess a good principle to keep in mind is that everything that appears countercultural is not necessarily countercultural. So, you know, the same corporate system, the same economic system, you know, sells you the suit and tie of a certain bourgeois respectability, and then it sells you the Harley Davidson with straight pipes where you can go out on the weekend and play it being Sonny Barger. But in some ways, even what appears countercultural is very much monitored by the culture, and it's not all that counter. When something truly countercultural emerges, it can be deeply disturbing and deeply moving, as, you know, I felt when I saw young people, supposedly these young people who are addicted to all their devices and don't care about privacy or public institutions, took to the streets in the Occupy movement to protest corporate malfeasance and economic inequality, and who actually went without their devices and wiggled their cold little fingers in the parks to vote, and were trying in some way to do something different, and to even in the way they organized their own protest. You know, all the luminaries, all the graying luminaries of the 60s showed up for one final encore in the spotlight and to tell the young folks how it ought to be done. And in some cases, the kids told them to go home. And I have to say, it was hard for me not to smile when they did that.
And yet those devices were absolutely essential to things like the Arab Spring and what happened in Tahrir Square.
Well, again, I would take out absolutely, and I would take out essential. They were tools that were used. But and again, it's the received narrative. If they hadn't been able to tweet, there would have been no revolt. And yet, it's funny, all the revolts in history that have occurred, including in the Middle East, where those devices did not exist. To argue that those devices weren't helpful is like arguing that a quill pen wasn't helpful when Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense. Of course they were helpful.
They were the tools of the time.
But the idea that they were absolutely essential, I simply disagree.
Well, we'll leave it on that note. Garrett Kaiser, his new book is Privacy. Garrett, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.